I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of October. Our guest this hour says we need mid-sized farming operations to survive and to be transitioned into a sustainable food system. Our system is in crisis because of the way that food is produced and the consolidation and organization of the industry in itself. And so we have a big issue to take on this hour with Winona Houter. She is the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Winona is the executive director of Food and Water Watch. It's a D.C.-based watchdog organization focused on corporate and government accountability relating to food, water, and common resources. And she owns a working farm in the Plains, Georgia. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm particularly interested because I know we have people who are farming throughout the state of Wisconsin and surrounding states, but I'm particularly interested in hearing your stories of how hard it is to keep a mid-sized farming operation going in this country, what forces are working against you, and we'll look at the whole local food movement and changing our food system in America. But those of you who are working the land will be particularly interested in hearing from you this hour. Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Winona, thank you so much for being with us. Hi. Is she there? Winona, are you there? Oh, she's on ISDN. Oh, I didn't know that. Excuse me. She's on a different system here. Hi, Winona. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I had the wrong button up. Why don't we start with your dad, who bought this farm in 1963, and it's still going. I love your description of him and where he put this farm, and it's really created something that's a legacy for you.
Well, that's right. The farm is in the Plains, Virginia, and it's 45 miles from Washington. Now, my dad got it in the early 60s. He didn't have very much money, and it was a really ramshackle farm with a mile-long rutted driveway. We never had plumbing in the house. He didn't really believe in creature comforts, and he never made very much money. And I learned a lot about how hard farmers work, though, and, you know, squished a lot of potato bugs, plucked chickens, and chopped kindling. And I can tell you, I couldn't wait to get away from that farm when I was 18 years old. But I learned a lot, and I always went back to it. And as an only child, I ended up inheriting that farm, which, of course, today is near a major metropolitan area. And so my husband runs it as a community-supported agriculture program with direct sales, because I was lucky enough to inherit a farm where there is a population that's willing to pay premium dollars for local food. Most farmers aren't so fortunate.
They sure aren't. I was astounded when I read the average income of the mid-sized family farmer in this country, and this is including a government subsidy. I don't know how anybody does it.
Well, that's exactly why agriculture is in such a crisis. The last time that the U.S. Department of Agriculture collected statistics, 2007, the average mid-sized farmer, and that's someone who has sales of between $100,000 and $250,000, the take-home pay was approximately $19,300, and about half of that was from the subsidy program. And there are a lot of factors that are leading to this kind of poverty amongst farmers. It's been the chipping away of the programs that were established during the New Deal. And today, the U.S. Department of Agriculture does no supply management. All of the emphasis is on production of commodity crops. Now, some years farmers make money, the very large farms, because of ethanol. But for most farmers, There's no market, whether they grow commodities, whether they have livestock. And we're increasingly seeing this in vegetables and fruit production, especially after the trade agreements of the mid-1990s. Today, about 50% of fruit comes from overseas. And 20% of vegetables, we actually believe it's higher. And even countries like China are sending us food items. In fact, they've become the third largest importer into the United States of processed fruits and vegetables. So when you go and buy that frozen corn or frozen edamame at a Whole Foods store, it could very well be coming from China. In fact, there's a good chance that it is.
Mm-hmm. And then we did a show recently about, it was really a moving program, a guy who spent time with people who were trying to cross into America from the border, and he was going with some people who had farmed. They were corn farmers for years and years and years, and their whole industry disappeared because of NAFTA. So they're trying to get into the United States, risking their lives in prison and all kinds of things because that's the only way they can make a living, because their living is gone, because corn from here is cheaper than the corn that they could sell right there.
That's right. You know, we almost never hear about this in the debate over immigration, but NAFTA destroyed agriculture in Mexico. All of those peasant farmers got moved into shanty towns in urban areas without the water infrastructure or the infrastructure, without jobs. And so, of course, they're going to come over the border to try to survive. And, of course, they are the labor, the cheap labor in the meat processing plants and in a lot of the places where fruits and vegetables are actually harvested.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the companies. These are also amazing statistics, Winona. 20 food corporations producing most of the food eaten by Americans, even organic brands, and 4 large chains controlling more than half of all grocery store sales. Who are those organizations and how did they get so big?
Well, I think this is one of the saddest stories because, you know, we have an economic system that's supposed to be built on competition. But since the 1980s, all of our federal policies have been directed at letting companies consolidate. And so today we do have about 20 food processing companies that control 60% of brands in grocery stores. The top five are PepsiCo, Nestle, Kraft, Tyson, and JBS, the giant, in fact, the world's largest meat company, Brazilian-owned, which owns some U.S. brands. And these food processing companies have figured out how to use fat, sugar, and salt to addict people to junk food. They've used their advertising to get children to be addicted to junk food. And, of course, the meat industry has really benefited from this consolidation. We have in the beef sector, we have 4 companies that produce 80% of beef. The hog market was completely restructured from this consolidation and from the cheap feed that became available after the United States joined the World Trade Organization and became a party to NAFTA. We completely deregulated farm policy in this country. And that's when commodities, the basis for feed for animals, became very cheap. So in 1998, we had 30% of hogs that were raised in factory farms because the consolidation had begun. By 2004, after the cheap feed became available, we had 70% of hogs raised on factory farms. And by 2007, when the USDA last did their survey, 95% of pork is raised on factory farms. And the people who actually do the contract agriculture to produce these animals, they have to get bigger and bigger and bigger to actually make a go of it. And what's causing this need for high volume goes beyond these big food processing companies. It really has to do with the consolidated grocery industry and the fact that we have four chains that overall control 50% of grocery sales, but in many, many parts of the country control 70 to 90% of grocery sales, with Walmart, of course, being the largest grocery chain, having just gotten into grocery sales in the last 12 to 15 years. And today, one out of three grocery dollars goes to Walmart. And the Walmart heirs have as much wealth as the bottom 40% of Americans. And I think that's a metaphor for what's happened to our food system and our economic system, too. And a store like Walmart or a chain like Walmart needs tremendous volume. And they don't want to deal with suppliers. They want giant suppliers. And this has even had an effect in the way our fruits and vegetables are grown. I went to the Central Valley of California in writing Foodopoly, and I found that even though traditionally farmers there have had, you know, maybe more than 1,000 acres, today they have to have thousands of acres to be profitable. And the shipper packers that deal with a Walmart, they have to be heavily capitalized, often by hedge funds, and have an offshore arm, either contractually, a contractual arrangement or an ownership arrangement. They have to have giant warehouses near airports. And, you know, this is major, major big business. And I think that that's what's so sad in this day when a lot of people want to have local agriculture really take off. But unless you can sell directly to the consumer, it's almost impossible for a farmer to get his or her product into the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. I would assume that because the economy isn't great for a lot of people, I think a lot of people are hurting much more than people in Washington believe they are, that the motivating factor, I guess, to go to a place like Walmart is because you get your food cheaper, right?
Well, you know, I think that's right. And I think it also has to do with, you know, the advertising, the everyday lower prices. And the problem is that for suppliers, even a PepsiCo or a Nestle, they really have to do whatever Walmart says. Mm-hmm. Contracts are non-negotiable. A supplier has to use Walmart's logistics, their data sharing programs. They have to give high volume discounts. They track their shipments from the manufacturing plant all the way to putting them on the store shelves. If there's a problem, a disruption of supply, the supplier is fined. It's a very ruthless industry, and unfortunately, all big box stores, any large grocery chain is copying these same techniques to try to compete with Walmart. And I must say that even Walmart isn't really on top of the food chain, that really it's a lot of this pressure does come from the deregulation of the financial services industry and the pressure for quarterly profits and the influence that the financial services industry has on policy making, and the fact that most of the emphasis on improving our economy is put on having higher stock prices, not having more distributed benefits for all parts of the economy. And I think that's why it's going to take a lot more than just focusing on food to fix our dysfunctional food mm-hmm. system. I think it really is just a symptom of needing to fix our democracy.
Let's put this in historical perspective for a moment. I found this interesting that you write early in the book about our dysfunctional food system, the result of long-standing farm and food policies proposed by some of the most powerful men in the country shortly after World War II. A couple questions. What did they propose that is still with us, and they're probably no longer with us? Is what we have now something they would be proud of, or did they not foresee some of the problems?
Well, I think these were industrialists. They were individuals that after the U.S. had become a manufacturing powerhouse, after World War II, after the center of finance had moved from Europe to the United States, they thought agriculture was kind of a has-been industry. They believed that consolidation was the future. They were interested in seeing young men move from the countryside, not take over their family farm, but to actually be labor in factories, especially the industrial north. And, you know, I think they were men who were technocrats. I don't think it was a conspiracy, although they did develop a strategy that was carried out over about 40 to 50 years that ended up depopulating many of the rural areas of the country that made it impossible for small and mid-sized farmers to really thrive. And I think as we look around the countryside today and see how difficult it is for people who are trying to farm, we can see what's happened, because I don't think they really realized the full impacts of what they were suggesting. I mean, it was right after World War II that this push to globalize food production really took off. And some of these men who were very active in lobbying, I mean, these were industrialists like the president of Studebaker, one of the large auto companies of that time, executive from Kodak Eastman. I mean, these were high-powered businessmen who had this vision of making the U.S. More industrialized. And, you know, when you go back and read a lot of the things that they wrote, they actually talked about industrializing the countryside, which sadly we are seeing today with a lot of the extractive industries moving into parts of the country that have traditionally grown our food. We see it with the proposal to frack, and a lot of the fracking that's going on in some parts of the country, or in Wisconsin, the mining of sand for fracking. And you know, I don't think that these men really probably fully understood what they were proposing, although they talked about the efficiency of vertical integration. I don't think they really wanted to make Americans overweight or sick from eating processed food.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Winona Howder. Her book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. It is a huge topic, as you've heard her outline, and we haven't even gotten to all the parts of the book yet. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're looking at what kind of system should be in place that would provide a decent living for people who are providing our food, and that will provide food that is healthy for everyone. And it turns out they're fairly complicated questions. To your calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And let's go to phone calls. Tony is our first caller in Marathon County. Hi, Tony.
Hi. This is an excellent subject, excellent host. Kathleen, you are my favorite WPR host by far, and this just confirms it over and over again.
Thanks,
I'm a small farmer in Marathon County. And the subject she is bringing up hits the nail on the head. It's this consolidation that there's no free market. It's driving small and mid-sized price takers out of this in droves. In Marathon County, we still have a great number of small dairy farms, but that number is dwindling fast because of a consolidation in the dairy industry. This is what the issue is. They did it to chickens. They did it to hogs. Now they're doing it to dairy. And when you do this, you lose a more sustainable system, because these small farmers are stewarding land in a better way. You lose vibrant local communities, but you lose economic democracy. Everyone had a little stake. There's broad-based and independent decision-making. And you also you lose people having that stake. You're really losing the agricultural American dream. My hope is the small food movement, or the local food movement, which is providing a lot of vibrant, small family farms throughout the country, but it's, again, like you said, closer to these bigger markets. And also in Marathon County, the grass-based or grazing movements, which I think could be like the terre noir of the small farms for Marathon County around the nation and the world.
Thank you, Tony, very much for the call. lot for you to respond to there, Winona.
Well, I totally agree. The dairy industry has been completely devastated by consolidation. We have one company, Dean Foods, that owns or controls 40% of Fluid Milk, 80% of organic milk, and 90% of soy milk. And it's very difficult for small dairy farmers to make a living. There's tremendous pressure to get more and more cows. And we've also seen the dairy industry move west to places like California, Arizona, mm-hmm. Because the waste, the tremendous amounts of waste when you have 2,000-3,000 cows can be dealt with in a drier climate, but of course is terrible for the ecosystem there. Now, you know, one of the things that caused me to write Foodopoly was I think there's a lot of hope in the local food movement that the movement can actually change the food system. And I think it can be a real benefit for some farmers who are near a metropolitan area or who are able to do direct sales or have some kind of gourmet food. But only a third of U.S. farms are anywhere near a metropolitan area. And we already see in some parts of the country where CSAs are becoming more competitive, where it's very difficult for farmers to get their product into a farmer's market because there's so many farmers that want to do direct sales. So while I think it is a real boom for those who can participate, and it's great for people who can actually enjoy those products, and I think it really helps create the kind of communities that we want to see, I don't think it's going to solve agricultural problems for most people, and I don't think it's going to change the food system.
So what
overall, I think that's going to take political action.
What kind of action?
We're going to need to vote with our fork. I want to say that is important, but then we need to vote with our vote. And then once we elect people, we need to hold them accountable. And I think that what the good food movement can do with this community building is actually get people involved in politics again. You know, I did a book event last night and somebody said to me, I don't do politics. Well, everything that has to do with our life is about politics. We're affected in, you know, what we buy, what we eat, what kind of housing we have. And all of these politics start at the local level. And I think that the good food movement is a way that people can get involved in local issues that affect food and the environment. And then we need to take it to the next step. You know, I think we've seen in Wisconsin and other states what happens when people are not involved enough in state legislative races. And then what happens is every 10 years, the state legislatures redistrict and decide who to send to Congress. And that's actually how we're in this mess today with the government being shut down. So I'd like to make the case that we actually need to revitalize our democracy. And people who are interested in food and resource issues can play an important part in that. We have a trade agreement that's coming up that will be voted on in Congress that's going to affect local foods or could have a major effect on local foods. And I think that would be a really good place for people to ask their local elected officials how they plan to vote on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So I do think that everything is political and that we need people to get involved in politics again at every level.
Thanks, Tony, for the call. John is joining us. He's a dairy farmer on a tractor right now, I think, chopping hay. And I'm glad you're listening. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A year ago, I agree that there is a problem with our food system. And a year ago, I had Senator Tammy Baldwin and Senator Amy Klobuchar, I live close to the Twin Cities, come to the farm, and I told them about some of the problems that have been going on with small family farm agriculture, because 21 years ago now, when I was in high school, there were 8 dairy farms on a 10-mile stretch. Now that we're down to 2.
Ooh.
I'm one of the 2.
Ooh.
And And some of the real big problems, see, with the case with Tammy Baldwin's opponent, Tommy Thompson, when he was governor, he was given million-dollar grants, not loans, grants, for these big dairy farmers to get bigger yet. And yet, farms like my size, which were 50-cow dairies, we couldn't even get a dime to modernize, you know, maybe put in a parlor. My newest tractor is 24 years old. I don't know if there's many people driving cars that are 20, 30, 40 years old. Actually, my oldest tractor is 40 years old, and it's still farming today. And the only reason I stay on the land is because my farm's paid for. I'm fourth generation dairy farmer. One part of our farm is almost 100 years old, and I have a daughter and a son that are fifth generation.
Mm.
So we really have to start talking about revitalizing rural America, and bigger is better is really destroyed the fabric of rural America because there's less students now in Spring Valley, Elmwood area where I'm from. I graduated from Elmwood in 96, and the opportunities for young people to stay here has been less and less because they were pushing for bigger and bigger.
So what do you need, John, in order to keep going and in order for what really used to be a part of the American dream is to have farm operations your size to keep those people from going under? What needs to happen?
Well, we need to have competitive markets. We need a place to sell our milk, sell our meat. You know, I do direct market. I'm open for all sorts of things to, you know, create new markets so we get more of the consumer dollar. I mean, you look at a loaf of bread, there's probably more money was probably paid out for the plastic that went with the bread than what the farmer got paid for the wheat or the farmer got paid for the sugar or other ingredients. There's more in advertisement dollars than what is going to the farmer. And, you know, we have to have a better share of the market. And, you know, we need a trust buster like Teddy Roosevelt to break up these food companies because they're really they're hoarding a lot of money that should be going to the people that are producing it.
Winona.
Yes, I totally agree with everything the caller said. And I think one of the things that we need to do is really begin putting more pressure on our members of Congress about antitrust. And I want to talk a little bit about Senator Globuchar, who, leading up to the Farm Bill, my organization, Food and Water Watch, put a lot of local pressure on Globuchar to actually support some of our recommendations for competitive markets, for actually looking at these antitrust violations. We want to see a competition title to the Farm Bill. She was completely cold to the idea, had no interest in it, and this is unfortunately what we see with both political parties. Both political parties have refused to do anything about this anti-competitive market. President Obama, when he was running for election the first time, promised to look into these non-competitive markets for dairy and for animal production. His administration started a process, and it was moving along very nicely. And then there was pressure from the meat industry before his second election. They started running ads as Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack traveled around the country saying that having competition, they didn't call it competition, of course, but that these competition hearings and that changing the policies to make a more competitive marketplace would cost jobs. And the Obama administration completely folded. And really, that's one of the reasons I wrote Foodopoly, is I think we need to start calling our political leaders on the monopolization that's been allowed. It's really the central problem in why we don't have jobs. A lot of our economic problems, we need to put the competition back into the marketplace. And we're going to need both parties to start supporting this. And I think that one of our political problems is that the parties prefer to keep their bases fighting over personal issues than really addressing these central economic issues. And we need antitrust enforcement, and we need to actually look at what the consolidation has done to agriculture and our food system, and actually all of our industries. Mm.
Thank you so much, John, for your call. I want to come visit your farm sometime. I want to go to a farm. It's, I think that a lot of people are feeling that. Let's go back to that loaf of bread or whatever you want to pick, because I think that he brought an image to mind, the plastic that's around the loaf of bread and where the money is going to, because it's good to – I think we need an understanding of that. And you do some of that in the book, the price of something that we don't even think about, where all the money is going. You want to do bread or something else?
Well, you know, I think it's just about any – farm product that we look at, very little of the cost of the food item goes to the farmer. For meat, it's about less than a quarter. And for some types of, like for corn flakes, I think it's 3 cents.
Oh, my gosh.
Actually, for a large box of corn flakes. I mean, we're talking about very little of the profit actually going back into the hands of the grower. But I think part of the problem is that there's no place for people who grow products to actually sell their, you know, whatever product
yes.
that they're growing. Whether it's, you know, if we're talking about animals, there's no fair market. There's no, you know, in the old days, you know, and I'm talking about 30 years ago, there may have been 4 different meat packers that someone who grows hogs could actually call up and see what the going price of hogs was,
uh-huh.
and they could kind of figure out where they were going to get a fair price. That just isn't the case today. We've had so much consolidation, and the way the companies that actually the meat packers actually operate, they kind of divide up the territories so that really a farmer who is raising hogs doesn't have any place to sell their animal except one meat packer. And so, you know, a lot of times we blame these contract growers. And, you know, a lot of these operations are horrific. But I think when you look at the central cause of the problem, it's coming from the way the market is actually shaped. And I don't think that people really realize how difficult it is for farmers to make a living.
No, I think you're right that they don't understand it. Carl in Madison, hi.
Yes, first of all, just listening to these farmers that are calling in, don't they just sound like the kind of people you want to sit down and talk to? And I
yes.
feel like small family farms are such an important part of who we are as America, and it is evaporating. I was just listening to the author and about this big ag and, you know, Walmart and its massive footprint, and I was thinking about the fact that if we had a tax on fossil fuels that is the mechanism by which these giant corporations truck, you know, their products right past these small family farms and into the, you know, these giant warehouses where people are shopping now. If there was a tax that, you know, not only affected the damage that carbon fuels are doing to our atmosphere, but also, you know, had an effect on these giant mechanized farming industries, you know, you'd pay more at the pump, but the money would go back in your pocket in the form of a check. You know, it would be redistributed back to the population, and I think it could really breathe some tremendous life into the small, you know, micro farming, small local businesses, because the fuel that run these huge factory farms is, it would, you know, it'd be just cost prohibitive for them to continue to do so. I was just curious the author's perspective on that.
Thank you, Carl.
Well, I'm afraid the cost of inputs, which are based on fossil fuels, and the cost of fuel is one of the reasons, or the high cost of fuel is one of the pressures on small and mid-sized farms, too. So I agree that some long-term policies addressing how we subsidize fossil fuels, how all of our public policy is directed at supporting our fossil fuel-based economy, need to be changed. But I think we're going to have to change a number of farm policies, that 1,000-page bill called the Farm Bill that we haven't been able to pass and which will pass in the same old form that won't really change the way that we produce food. That's one of the places that we need a competition title. We need our research dollars to be going into programs that help sustainable farming. We need a way for young farmers to be able to purchase land. We need those types of loans. I mean, there are dozens of policies that we're going to need to change to move into a sustainable food system. And I think the competition issue is one of the most important ones. But, you know, I don't think we can be discouraged by the deep problems that we're in. I think we have to look at this as a long-term commitment to step-by-step changing these policies. And the first thing that we're going to need to do is get people involved in building the political power to actually change some of these policies, from the policies on fossil fuels to farm policy. And I'm afraid there's no real shortcut to doing that. We have to go back to old-fashioned grassroots organizing, and we need people to move away from their television sets and to spend a little bit more time on civic affairs. And I don't mean to be preachy about that, but I do think it's we're going to have to get involved in taking back our democracy, probably working on a constitutional amendment to get money out of politics. And I'm real excited as I travel around the country, and I've been doing that since January with Foodopoly, to see so many people enthused about taking our democracy back again, because I think that is our what a central goal has to be, to improve our food system and, you know, to really pass on a world to our children that we want to, and to address all of these long-term environmental problems like climate change.
More phone calls in a moment. Carl, thank you for yours. Our guest this hour is the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Winona Howder is our guest. She's executive director of Food and Water Watch, which is a D.C.-based watchdog organization focusing on corporate and government accountability relating to food, water, and common resources. She also knows a bit about farming because she owns a working farm in the Plains, Virginia, and her husband works the farm. Our number, did I give it to you? 800-486-8655. You can also leave messages via email, talk@WPR.org, or our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dent Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Wausau West High School's choir group temporarily disbanded after the choral director was asked by the school board to limit the amount of religious music performed at its holiday concert. This controversy will be discussed on Central Time today after 3. All right, back to phone calls. Marie in Round Lake Beach, Illinois. Hi.
Yeah, hello. My comment is, or question is, I'm concerned about the food coming from Mexico. I have noticed in the past few years that the grocery stores up here are importing more and more food from Mexico, and I'm wondering about the quality of that food in terms of safety. And I also want to agree with Ms. Howder's comments about, in particular, changing the redistrict policy. The way they're doing it now, I think, is what's causing our problems. And doing the grassroots stuff to change that, to make it, get rid of all the gerrymandering. But let's go back to Mexico.
All right. Yeah, we've got so many issues on the table this hour. It's huge. What about food from Mexico?
Well, there's no doubt that one of the reasons that fruit and vegetable production is going to Mexico and other Latin America countries is it's cheaper to produce, the environmental laws aren't as stringent, and the companies can often get away with using chemicals that might be illegal here or maybe illegal there. And so this is all about cost cutting, and it's really changed the shape of fruit and vegetable production in the United States, so that many states, like, for instance, Michigan used to be a big fruit producer, produces much less fruit today. We see apples that used to be produced in states like Virginia, West Virginia. Well, today, many apples are produced in China. And in fact, when you drink apple juice, you're likely to be getting juice that was produced from Chinese apple concentrate. So it's Mexico, it's most of the Latin American countries, and even Asia, and we're seeing more and more of our fruits and vegetables produced overseas. And for people might be interested to know that with the government shutdown, there still is meat inspection for pork and beef and chicken, but for those imported fruits and vegetables, we're not seeing inspection at the border. Not that there was very much inspection to begin with. We shouldn't kid ourselves.
Thanks very much, Marie, for the call. Jeff on email says he raises a handful of beef steers organically. He finds a local market from people who are concerned with the source and quality of the meat from big farms.
Well, I think that is true. There are farmers who are finding a market for the animals that they produce. Depends where they live. But I think we just have to look at states like Iowa, Nebraska, the Great Plains states. What happens if all of the farmers decide to sell 12 steers? They don't have a market. They don't have a population base. In fact, most farmers own the equipment for, if we're talking about those Midwestern states, for corn and soy. They have the planting equipment, the harvesting equipment, and they don't really have enough of a population for most farmers to sell direct. So I think it's wonderful when people can do that and make a living, and some people are making a living, but it's a very, very small percentage of farmers who are able to do that.
Deb in Amherst, hi.
Hi, this is Deb. I actually work for Wisconsin Farmers Union. As you were talking about earlier with the grassroots organization, that's exactly what we do. Our national office actually puts out the farmer's share of the retail food dollar every month. It's a national average of how much the farmer actually makes off of something. It's generally about 16 cents of every dollar. So it's a very small amount. But with Wisconsin Farmers Union and National Farmers Union, we're working really hard to keep some of these smaller programs going, the value-added food things. We just started the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, and so we have small to medium-sized producers that are aggregating their vegetables to be able to sell into the larger grocery stores. So we're trying to do a lot of those things. Another really good thing that we're looking forward to is the Affordable Care Act. Now that that's starting, it's actually going to give our farmers an option, an affordable option, for them to be able to continue to do what they love and provide the safe and healthy food that they are for our communities. So any of those small things are going to be able to help us keep our farmers going.
Mm. Are you seeing that a lot of farmers are going without insurance now, Deb?
What we're doing is we're really getting the word out there that this is a good, affordable option
right
for our farmers.
But they had,
right now, if you look at, go ahead.
What had they been getting for insurance?
Some of them don't have any insurance at all because, number one, it's too expensive. They can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, some insurance companies haven't even been covering them just because of the type of job that they have, because it's a higher-risk job. And some of them are on Badger Care, which is wonderful. We're so glad to be able to have that available for some of our families. But obviously that's going away, you know, part of that's going away as well. So, you know, this way they're getting in. Otherwise, you know, one person has to work off the farm to be able to provide the health insurance for their family. So, you know, one is running the farm by themselves, you know, and the other one's helping after work, things like that, and just not doing what they love.
Mm-hmm. Winona.
Well, the National Family or the National Farmers Union is a wonderful organization and has many state affiliates, Wisconsin's Nebraska Farmers Union. It's definitely an organization that's fighting for family farmers and really for fair prices for consumers. And there are some other wonderful farm organizations. The Wisconsin Family Farm Defenders, it works with dairy farmers. It's a member of the National Family Farm Coalition that does a lot of work. I know at Food and Water Watch we do a lot of work in trying to change farm bill policies. So I think it's really important that we work with farmers. And too often I'm afraid that, especially in the environmental community, it's easy to demonize farmers. Well, we need to have common cause with farmers and to really work to make it possible to save family farms so that they can transition into a sustainable food future.
You said earlier, Winona, that we shouldn't be discouraged, but when you talk about the enormous change in the way food is grown and delivered in this country, not just in this country, but on a worldwide basis, it seems to me as though we've undergone a radical transformation for all of these huge farms and just a few companies providing all the food that's coming our way and so many family farms having gone under. Holy Toledo, what a job to change everything. I just can't imagine how it would be accomplished. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, I think we either all give up and go to the beach and forget about it and forget the next generation, and I'm just being flippant, or we actually have to get down to the hard work of organizing to try to bring some political change to this country. And I know that's why at Food and Water Watch, we try to give everybody an avenue to get involved. It's why we have 17 state offices. We believe that the real action is at the state level, people getting involved in their local issues, and issues bring people to politics. And I think that there's not going to be any shortcut. And I'm really hoping that all of the enthusiasm about food, all of the concern about climate change is going to bring people together to engage in those activities in their community, to bring up a new generation of young people who are educated on these issues, who are going to be willing to run for public office, and that we begin building the recognition that we have to get money out of politics if we're going to straighten out a lot of these big systemic changes. And what I do is I try to keep in mind kind of the spectrum of human history and how long it's taken to accomplish some of the things that we've needed to accomplish. You know, whether you're talking about undoing feudalism or more recently organizing earlier in the last century for the 8-hour workday or for the civil rights movement or to get child labor out of factories. These were 50-100-year campaigns. And I think that, you know, we have to be prepared to do the hard work of educating people, mobilizing them, and getting people active again. And we need to do it quickly because we have a lot of challenges in the future with climate change and feeding people.
Thanks, Deb. Ellen in Milwaukee. Hi.
Well, hello. I am. This is just a wonderful hour, and I just wanted to say I remember when food was really, really, really good. And although I'm going to be 72 next month, that was probably quite a long time ago. But when I was a child, my mother worked on Broadway in Milwaukee, in the third ward?
Yes.
I believe. And she came home in the evening because the people there knew that she was the mother of 7 children, raising them alone. They just filled the back of her station wagon with produce so that we ate very, very well. And it was wonderful because this is where the food was brought to the city. And it was, that isn't done anymore. It's just totally different.
Do you notice a complete difference in the quality, Winona?
Well, there's no doubt that there's a difference in the quality and taste of food in grocery stores, and that's one of the things that the local food movement is bringing back to farmers markets and CSAs and, you know, a lot of the education programs for children, because I think we have such an urban population today that most people live in cities and their children don't know where food comes from.
Right.
And so part of fixing our food system, I do think, is these education programs.
No doubt about it. Winona, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Winona Hauter, her book is Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Next week is a big part of our future. It's our fall pledge drive, a very important drive for us, so I hope you'll join us. We'll be having All Things Political Monday at, we'll say 9. It's 1 o'clock. Craig Gilbert, one of our favorite guests, will join us. Robert Dalek will be with us. This, of course, is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. He is the nation's preeminent JFK historian. He will be with us next week. We're going to be talking about, and we're going to have doggies in our studio. We love those days. Therapy dogs will be next week. Woof, woof, and many other great conversations. So thanks to KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. Good conversations are coming your way.